Specialist's Corner.
All right, I am here today with psychiatrist Dr. Sean Hersevoort, and he is currently the National Medical Director for Foresight Mental Health. And in addition to this, he has 20 years of experience in patient care, program design, and education with such illustrious institutions as UC Davis, UC Irvine, and UCSF. More near and dear to our hearts here on Right on Prime is that for the last 10 years, he spent most of his time working in the field of primary care psychiatry, educating and consulting to primary care providers. Welcome, Sean. It's so good to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's been a while since I did a podcast, so I'm happy to be back.
The topic we decided to cover today is major depressive disorder, which we more commonly refer to as depression. And this is a big topic, so this will be a piece in two parts. The second part will focus on management, and here we're going to look at prevalence, etiology, presentation, and evaluation. Gee, I know we both see a lot of this in our practices, but how widespread is this condition?
Yeah, so it's actually the number one cause of disability and premature death in adults 18 to 44. And it is present in about 15% of primary care patients. In a commercial population, in a Medi-Cal or Medicare clinic, that's double or triple.
Wow.
Yeah, rates are as high as 30 to 50% in patients with chronic illnesses like coronary artery disease, cardiovascular, diabetes, obesity, HIV, cerebrovascular disease, which obviously is a huge percentage of our patients. Up to a quarter of adults globally will have depression at some point in their life. And most likely, they're going to experience this between 12 and 25 or over 65.
I'm glad you mentioned that it's really often seen in people who have comorbid conditions, because it almost seems like when a person starts developing all these different chronic conditions, you know, dollars for donuts, that they're going to add depression to the list. It's really quite something to see.
Eventually, and the opposite is true too. If you're depressed and anxious long enough, your cardiovascular and diabetes illnesses are going to flourish as well.
Yeah, they do travel hand in hand, don't they? Well, let's take a few minutes to talk about the causes of depression. It would be nice to think that it was just clear cut. Oh, you've got a gene that makes a certain protein and that's why you're depressed. But life and practice has told us that it's not that straightforward.
Well, sometimes it is, but you're right. It generally varies quite greatly. The best way to think about it is looking at the biopsychosocial concept, where all three factors are usually at play. What I tell patients is that there's almost always a biological and a psychological component. And that biological, like you said, can be genetic, hormonal, acute or chronic illness, chronic pain, etc. And the psychological is going to relate to what life experiences they've had, what's happened to them historically and recently, and how they reacted to it. Now, a factor that we didn't used to pay enough attention to, and we are more so now, is the social component, which acts as a modifier. If you have immense adverse childhood experiences, negative ACEs, that's going to make things a lot harder for you at all ages. And on the flip side, somebody who really just demonstrates strong resilience can really do better faster.
Yeah, okay. And I'm glad you mentioned the social component, because in primary care, we see firsthand the impact of those social determinants of health. Like, it's hard to look after your mental health if you're struggling on a daily basis for food and for education and shelter.
Absolutely.
Now, I was hoping we could go over some of the presentations of depression, because this is not a cookie cutter disease. People come in needing help with their mental health, presenting quite differently.
Very true. Just as you could probably tell me that every patient with hypertension and diabetes presents a little differently, I'll tell you the same.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So by definition, all people have to experience either loss of pleasure or depressed mood. Everybody has those. The most common presentation includes prominent anxiety and insomnia. Sometimes we call that anxious or stimulated depression. There's also what we call atypical or lethargic depression, which presents with low energy, hypersomnia, and increased appetite. And then there's a third type that we don't see as frequently, but is worthy to discuss, which is melancholic depression. And that's a very severe form of depression, including severe loss of pleasure, guilt, anorexia, insomnia, that is quite grave and usually requires an escalation of care. There are other aspects of all depressions that you will see such as irritability and enhanced experiences of negative emotions and sensations like pain. So anxious and depressed people feel more pain and they feel it more intensely.
Interesting. It's not as much that the depression is causing the pain as the depression is causing them to interpret things more so as pain.
Well, I think about it as an amplifier. If we treat the depression, the volume on your pain, let's say, would just turn down a little bit.
Yeah, which is what we often see when people have comorbid depression and fibromyalgia or other pain syndromes. Getting that depression under control certainly can help.
You got it.
Let's look at the DSM-5 for a moment. This is really the kind of the gold standard for diagnosis. What do they say specifically about depression?
So although everyone, like we said, experiences depression differently, they all follow a somewhat predictable pattern. So the DSM, or DSM-5, where we are now, demonstrates that you need 2 or more weeks of symptoms, including at least 5 of 9, think half, of good old SIGE caps, you know, sleep, interest, guilt, energy, concentration, appetite, psychomotor, and suicidality. And we can use the DSM-5, but you really have to factor it through real life. You need to see that the patients are clearly suffering and that it's interfering with their function. Without those, it's really just sadness.
And I would say that the duration of 2 weeks or more would surprise many people. I know by the time my patients are coming to see me about depressive symptoms, it's certainly been more than 2 weeks.
Yeah, really. I mean, at 2 weeks, we note that there's something serious going on. The reality is that people can sustain a depression for 6, 12, 18 months, even years.
Now, if we're wondering about depression, but our patients haven't specifically said they're coming in because of their mood, are there different screening tools that we could use to help?
Absolutely. The main sort of meat and potatoes is the PHQ-9 for depression and the GAD-7 for anxiety, because they're so tightly tied together. You know, the PHQ-9 is really my best friend in primary care, and it gets the job done beautifully all the way from 12 years old up to 100 years old. That being said, some folks would prefer something a little more tailored to their patient population. So we have wonderful accessory tools. We have the PHQ-9 adapted for teens, the EDPS, the Edinburgh for peripartum depression, the GDS geriatric for over 65, and a wonderful tool that's very underutilized called the DMI, depression in the medically ill, for patients with chronic medical illnesses.
Now, these screening tools, can they be used to monitor therapy as well? Like, can you diagnose a patient, get them started on treatment, and then redo the screening tool?
Absolutely. Everything that I listed can be used both for diagnosis and for following treatment. That's not always true, but most of the scales that I use are usable for both.
Okay. And would your practice be to redo the scale at each visit?
Depends on the frequency of visit.
Yeah.
I will tend to do them about every other visit, unless I'm trying to make a medication decision, and then I like to bring them in as sort of one more piece of information.
Okay, good to know. Now, we spoke earlier about how depression often accompanies physical illness, but we know we often see it in a cluster of other mental health conditions.
Yeah, unfortunately, like our medical health conditions, depression rarely travels by itself. But anxiety, insomnia, and substance abuse are very frequent hangers-on. Depression tends to be sort of a common pathway for most mental and medical illnesses, for that matter. Patients who suffer with obsessive-compulsive disorder, PTSD, ADHD, eating disorders, or virtually anything else will virtually always end up depressed.
I'm going to put you a bit on the spot here, but do you sometimes see mood disorder or depression as a harbinger to dementia? I'm asking that because I can think of about 5 patients in the last 10 years who developed depression, which was managed, and then a couple of years later went on to develop dementia.
So it's a great question, and it's a big part of our primary care psychiatry work. So depression in its true form often comes in the elderly, like we mentioned, and is a harbinger to actual dementia. It's one of the first symptoms we see preceding actual neurocognitive decline. But the flip side is that there are times when it's what we call pseudo-dementia. They look depressed. They're starting to look like they're having neurocognitive decline. You treat the depression and the neurocognitive decline actually pauses and reverses. So the nice thing is we don't have to do anything differently. We recognize symptoms of depression, we treat them. But the nice thing is some of the time we're wrong about the dementia and we won't need to proceed with that treatment.
What sort of an evaluation do we need to do beyond making the diagnosis?
Sure, and this is every day for every one of us in either psychiatry or primary care. So The way you want to think about it is really the two simple arms, medical and then mental. So the medical list is far too long to go into. Could mostly be identified by a CBC, a CMP, a UTOX, and a TSH. That's going to catch 90-95% of the medical causes. Mentally, think AMPS. We use this when we teach our courses. So AMPS.
A.
Anxiety.
M.
Mood, including bipolar.
P.
Psychosis.
S.
And substance use. So of all of those, they're all pretty self-evident except bipolar, which is always the trickiest for you and for us in psychiatry. Bipolar 1, not so much. Weeks of unlimited energy, euphoria or rage, dangerousness, psychosis, hospitalization, arrest. We all pretty much catch bipolar 1. But it's the bipolar 2 that's really subtle, with a little bit of elevated mood, energy, activity, depression, or rather suppressed sleep. So my best advice for those, unless you are an expert in bipolar 2, would be to confirm a bipolar 1 with an MDQ, a mood disorders questionnaire. And for bipolar 2, the BSDS, the Bipolar Spectrum Disorder Scale, is a godsend. Now, in reference to your question before, these are diagnostic only. And if you're just still not sure, refer.
Okay, good to know. I had not heard of the BSDS. That would be very helpful rather than asking those questions like, so have you ever had a lot of energy, but maybe not too much energy? Because some of those questions for bipolar 2 just seem far more difficult to tease out.
Absolutely. And this is why I really love assessment tools, rating scales, because in that moment, they make everyone a DSM-5 expert.
It's true. Bye-bye imposter syndrome. I'm now a DSM-5 expert. Okay, so this is a good place to put a pause on this discussion with Sean Hersevoort about depression. We've established that it's very common, that its presentation does vary, that the cause can be quite multifactorial, and that it can exacerbate other conditions. I invite you to join us for part 2, where Sean reviews management, because as we know, even though the diagnosis can sometimes be tricky, management is even more nuanced.